From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. Welcome to another episode of UBC Arts on Air, a lively program of profiles and discussions with members of the UBC Faculty of Arts. And I'm your host, Ira Nadell. This evening, Professor Renisa Mawani from the Department of Sociology and a specialist in non-European migration, especially, I have to add, to the west coast of Canada. Welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, this topic of migration is so vast. How did you become interested in it?
I think, well, originally when I went to graduate school, I was planning to do a project looking at Indigenous European relations and questions of colonization. But I think that my own family history of migration, of numerous migrations, really influenced the ways in which I was thinking about European colonialism. And so part of that first project was to include Chinese migration in discussions of European Aboriginal relations on the West Coast. And then from there, I became interested in Indian migration in the late 19th and early 20th century, and that's the topic of my current book.
So would you say that your own family has a colonial history?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So my great-great-grandfather left the northwest part of India, Gujarat, which was, of course, under British rule, and migrated to the eastern coast of Africa, so to Kenya. And my grandparents and my parents were born there, as was I, and then my parents left in the 70s, largely because they were concerned about Idi Amin and what would happen, and came to Canada. So I'd say that we've moved from British colony to British Columbia, absolutely.
Did the family kind of keep a history, a bit of a record of all this, or this is something you've just, you became aware of it as you grew up in Canada or as you, became an academic?
No, there's no record. There are no records that I know of. I mean, this is certainly something that I would like to investigate, because I imagine that there would be shipping records, for example, of my great-great-grandfather's journey to Kenya. And I know that my grandparents certainly went back to India several times and crossed the Indian Ocean on ships that at the time also carried cars. So it was really just out of interest that, and also listening to my parents talk about the effects of migration, their reasons to leave, the kinds of choices that they've had to make as a result. But it really, it's been a very important part of, a very formative part of my life.
Do you think that in such circumstances, especially with families, there's ever a tinge of regret, a feeling that, well, perhaps, had we stayed or not been away so long, things might have been different?
Absolutely. When my parents first came to Vancouver, I was three, and my mother was just devastated and said that, she didn't think that she could live here. We were the first of our family to move to the West Coast. And my father convinced her that we should stay for a year and see how things went. And then when we went back, she realized that she had actually changed quite considerably, that Nairobi had changed quite considerably, and that it would be the best decision for our family if we stayed in Canada and in Vancouver in particular. And I think it's been a difficult decision. I think I don't think that they've fully ever felt that this is their home. They've had to deal with a lot of racism and, downward mobility, not having their access to, or the kinds of social capital that they had developed in Kenya. But, you know, they made huge sacrifices for us. And this is certainly something that I continually remind my own children, that, you know, we need to remember that these are the sacrifices that are that your grandparents have made in order for you to be here.
Yes, I think that's terribly, terribly important. But do you think it's our personal histories somewhat that shape our professional slash academic interests?
Well, I think most of us who spend this painful time writing are really passionate about things, and I think that in many ways those passions come from lived experiences, whether it's or personal histories or geographies, whether it's, you know, a journey or an experience or a book that we've read that has, you know, had life-changing effects. I think certainly the personal is always intellectual and the intellectual is always personal.
Is there accident at play, do you think, as we end up doing what we love to do? Or do you think it's part of a plan?
No.
And you can take 2 days to answer that question.
I'm a firm believer in serendipity. So I think that if I had, you know, predicted where I would be after finishing graduate school, I certainly don't think that I would have predicted being where I am now.
I understand that only too well. But that's what makes it so fascinating, I think. If
it
we
does.
Just followed an outline, it wouldn't have the same kind of urgency or intensity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the question of urgency is really key. I think that many times the issues that become of interest to us or to me in particular are ones that are really inspired or motivated by a kind of political urgency. That was definitely the case with my doctoral research, for sure. And certainly through my career trajectory.
Are you able to access archives easily in terms of the kind of work that you want to do, both past and, you know, present?
Yes, it's been really wonderful, actually, to see how easily I've been able to get access to things. Part of that has to do with the fact that many of the records that I'm looking at are more than 100 years old, and it's been easy to get access. What has been really remarkable to see is that many of the same records are being used over and over again, and one of the really exciting things about the project that I'm working on now is to see the range of archival sources that I've been able to find in Glasgow, in the British Library, in Delhi at the National Archives of India, and many of them are sources and documents that I have never seen before, even though I've been researching this for the last decade.
Yes, I think we should mention that the current project is the wonderfully titled Across Oceans of Law, focusing on the Komagata-Maru voyage of 1914. But what's different about your approach to this subject, which certainly has been discussed, written about, documented for many, many years? What's unique about what you're doing?
So when I originally started this project, I was really struck by the fact that the Komagata-Maru, even though it was a British-built ship, Japanese-owned, chartered by a Punjabi migrant who had been living in Malaya and Singapore for 25 years, that it had been written about and narrated as a Canadian story, a story of arrival and a story about immigration and about racism and a national history. And while all of these are really, really important arguments and histories to be told, what I was really interested in was the ship's global significance. So I was interested in the fact that it left Hong Kong, that it made stops in Shanghai, Moji, Yokohama, arrived in Vancouver on the way back, stopped in Yokohama and Kobe, in Singapore, and then in India. And I was also really struck that we know so little about the Middle Passage and, you know, what was happening with the passengers. We knew or still know very little about Gurdit Singh, other than he's, you know, described as a wealthy entrepreneur or a wealthy businessman. And so I was really interested in what was happening on this ship while it was at sea, because it did spend a lot of time at sea. So the book is a global maritime legal history, and it's focused on various forms of law, the British common law, admiralty law, immigration law. It's also focused on questions of time and space. So I think that the ocean, given the ways in which it's bisected and, you know, organized through longitude and latitude, is a site that must be thought about not only spatially but also temporally. And I'm really interested in everything that is oceanic.
So is this what you mean? I think you mentioned in perhaps an interview that we study a ship oceanically?
Yes.
What is, to explain that? I love the word.
So to study a ship oceanically means to really think about its movements across ocean spaces. So the Komagatamaru, for example, did not just make a trans-Pacific journey, but it also crossed the Indian Ocean on its return to Calcutta. One of the chapters in my book looks at the vessel itself and all of its many owners. So as the Steubenhoek in 1890, it made numerous passages across the Atlantic Ocean, carrying migrants from Hamburg and Antwerp to Montreal. And then as the Cecilia, it brought numerous, again, European passengers from Hamburg, Germany, from Turkey, Algeria, and other Mediterranean ports to Boston, Montreal, and Ellis Island. And I think in the course of 4 years, the numbers of passengers that the ship brought just to Ellis Island was over 40,000. So I'm interested really in the connections between these different oceanic regimes that we see as being separate. We think about the Atlantic, we think about the Pacific, we think about the Indian Ocean, and indeed there are whole fields of study organized around these regions. And I wanted to situate the ship, to follow the ship across these different oceans in order to think about other ways of writing history.
Do you have access to logbooks and records? You speak very eloquently about, you know, I love the phrase the middle passage, you know, and the ship's movement here, there, and everywhere. But do you have access to any documents that can tell you what life was like on the ship?
Well, that's an interesting question. Until recently, I didn't actually have access to very much. So I know that Gurdit Singh, the man who charted the ship, had written a diary at sea, and the diary was confiscated when the ship arrived in Calcutta in September 1914, and that diary's gone. He did recreate a kind of memoir while he was a fugitive and while he was in prison, and then that was published as in a Punjabi version and also in an English version. And in that, he gives us a little bit of a sense of what was happening at sea. But when I was at the British Library, I came across a whole set of thousands of pages of documents, and included in those documents are passengers' testimonies of conflicts that were happening aboard the ship with one another, with the crew. About food is a really big issue. So the kinds of conflicts that emerged with Gurdit Singh around rations and around food, and the ways in which the passengers actually mediated and organized themselves in order to ensure that they had proper provisions.
Normally, how many passengers would have been on the ship?
So the ship's tonnage was 2,929, and I just was reading a statute governing indenture in Hong Kong, which was being used to in very complicated ways around the ship. So according to that, the ship would have only been able to carry a maximum of 290 passengers, even though there were 376 aboard. Gurdit Singh had, after chartering the ship, had renovated, made changes to the lower decks, and claimed that he could carry as many as 530 passengers. And he tried to recruit as many as possible, but because of the authorities in Hong Kong that were trying to prevent him from actually leaving the colony, he lost many passengers in the process.
I'm curious, was there, it's a bit foolish question, one captain for most of this, or did we go through a series of captains for the ship?
So there was originally one captain, and he decided that he didn't want to embark on this voyage. So at the last minute, a second captain was appointed to the ship. And both the captain and the crew were Japanese. So there was a Japanese captain and 40 Japanese crew members. But under the charter party that Gurdit Singh signed, he essentially had full control over the ship, other than the areas that were reserved for the captain and the crew. And it's interesting that we hear very little about the captain throughout the voyage. It's only when the ship returns to, or when the ship arrives in Calcutta and the Commission of Inquiry is actually questioning witnesses, that there's a lengthy interview with the captain. So for all intents and purposes, Gurdit Singh assumed that he was the captain of the ship. And he did have legal authority through the charter party. So he was held responsible for providing provisions for the passengers. He was responsible for paying any incidental fees. And even though he was from Punjab, from a small village in the Amritsar district, authorities called him the captain of Bengal.
That's pretty nice. Now, I know that you're also thinking of another new area of study, the legalities of nature, with particular attention to insects. Can
yes.
you elaborate? I find this fascinating. First of all, because you're moving from a nautical focus to something on land, and from something which is truly global and international in the transport of individuals and cultures, to something which is almost microscopic.
So one of my very brilliant colleagues told me that he could describe my career as follows, that my first book was focused on land because I was really concerned with issues around law and colonization. My second is focused on water. And the third project, the legalities of nature and the insect portion of that, is focused on air. So I never actually thought of it that way. I was mostly just concerned and interested, or I just sort of followed my interests, but I thought, oh, that's a really interesting way to characterize it. And there are some sort of continuities between what I'm working on now and the insect project. So the project itself is called Insect Jurisprudence, and I'm really interested in the relationship between law and insects over the past several hundred years, because we've moved from having insects appeared as defendants in chancery courts, for example. And in the contemporary moment, we see that insects essentially have very little agency, right? They're entities or commercial products, such as bees, that are in need of legal protection, as opposed to agents that are working socially or legally in particular ways. So in the ship project, I'm really interested in the ship as a living and agentive being. And certainly under Admiralty law, under British and particularly under U.S. Admiralty law, there was something called vessel personification, where the ship was considered to be a legal person. Part of this was around ensuring that Americans and British patrons didn't have to go to foreign courts in order to deal with conflicts that happened at sea. They could just simply sue the ship. But it was also a way of the U.S. and Britain to extend their jurisdiction over the seas, right? So I am really interested in the ways in which non-human entities have a certain kind of personhood. So the ship as a legal person, but also the ocean, when we think about voyages and the ways in which oceans were forces to be contended with, right? Voyages had to be planned around, and in fact were legally barred from leaving at particular times because of bad weather or monsoons and so on and so forth. And so these interests really sort of inform this project on the legalities of nature and on insects in particular. I'm really interested in trying to undo this, not just the nature-culture binary, but the nature-law binary, and thinking about the ways in which law always has a relationship to those tangible forces that we consider to be natural.
Well, of course, there's always been the issue about animals and law, and I understand we have quite an established set of precedents and statutory regulations, etc. But with insects, I think very few people have ever thought about it in this context.
Well, it's interesting that insects are really significant in social life as a kind of barometer for the future, right? So when we think about climate change, we think about the adaptability or plasticity of insects, also the ways in which they're used as prototypes for drones, for example, or other nanotechnologies that are used in as sort of futuristic devices in war. But I also was really interested in insects as opposed to other kinds of animals because they lack the same kind of we don't have the same kind of relationship to insects as we do with dogs or with other domestic animals. And we have a hard time thinking of them beyond the aggregate, right? And beyond an invasive species. They can't be pets. I mean, they could be, but not very successfully, I think. So, you know, so I thought I wanted to pick a sort of extreme that was particularly relevant in the contemporary context and that has this amazing history that's waiting to be written, and to sort of focus on that as opposed to the more obvious examples of dogs or other domestic pets.
I think it's really fascinating, and I can just imagine the kind of research you'll have to do for that sort of subject. It's really been remarkable, and I'm delighted to have had you here this evening. Many thanks then to Renisa Mawani from the Department of Sociology for joining us on UBC's Arts on Air. And stay tuned for future discussions with the always engaging members of UBC's Faculty of Arts. Thank you again.
Thank you.